No, we won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we
good morning and welcome to the Third Soul Show, where we the people are now in session. Well, it's going to be an interesting show today. I was finishing up my notes, about ready to print them out, and my entire system failed. Like, my computer, everything just froze up on me. Have not been able to get back into my notes, so we're kind of winging it today. A little bit of no notes here, so you'll have to bear with me throughout the show. It should be a good time. But today we have a really great show, providing that we can pull this off without the notes here. We have a really great show coming up for you. We get Yuri. That will be up in just a moment. Followed by that will be Representative Fred Clark from the 42nd Assembly District. We will finish out the hour with the Dem response to the State of the State. You've all heard the State of the State. So I'm going to play the Dems response, because I don't think anyone has heard the Dems response, and they've got some really good response. All right. So we'll end the first hour with that. We'll start the second hour with the Dems response. Then we'll go to Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy and finish off the show with Nate Tim, who's going to talk about the Grassroots Festival that's going on the 18th. But without further, any more delay, we're going to get to Yuri Raskin. Good morning, Yuri. How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well, Sarah. I'm sure you're going to do just fine. I think that once you have done the research and your brain had been exposed to that information, even if computer crashes, I'm sure it's somewhere in there, still in your own personal hard drive, and you're going to get through this just fine.
I hope you're right. We'll see what I can pull out of my head as we keep going here.
You'll be surprised, I bet.
So what's some of the news for the week?
Well, you know, being in southern Wisconsin, we pay attention to what our state senator is doing, and Democratic State Senator Tim Cullen is bowing out of the governor's race, saying that he can't raise the money to compete with better-known opponents. I think that from my personal understanding is when the process changed from the party leadership to union leadership to an open primary, I think it became very clear that it's going to be difficult for Senator Cullen to make it through the primary, because he has a much stronger appeal to, middle and right, and he doesn't have that strong grassroots support that you really need to get the whole state riled up to win the primary. So I think that was another smart decision there by Senator Cullen, because there's some strong candidates. Hopefully, will emerge more stronger candidates that will get people riled up about going and voting against Walker and for somebody. It's such a weird race we have, because it's not just about the Walker. It's not just about the two candidates. It's about the fact that it's a recall election, so it kind of brings a whole new dynamic that I think is very important that people don't forget. Because right now we have, for instance, State Senator Kathleen Vinehout. She's taken steps to enter governor's race. And already you can hear on social media some buzz that she was for this, but she was against something else, and people starting to apply almost a litmus test to everybody who is running. And the concern that I have is that we remember that this is about recalling Scott Walker. So we need to get behind the candidate that wins the primary, obviously, but then not worry so much about the details, because we know that Scott Walker is going to be 100 times worse.
Well, what do you think about the flack that's coming from around Kathleen Falk? I know a lot of people in Madison absolutely love her. I am hearing from the people outside of Madison that they're not real great about her or fond of her. What do you think of that? I know you were just talking about getting behind the people running.
I think that this is the great thing about the primary, is that all of this information is going to get flushed out, and there isn't anybody really, I don't think it's been about 2,000 years, that claimed to walk on water. So we're not going to have that candidate that's going to be everything to everybody, no matter what your preferences are. So I'm sure that there's some things that Senator Vinehout has done that have made some people unhappy. Frankly, that's the nature of being in politics. How does her record compare with that of her opposition in the primary is a very important question. So I think right now we need to see who else emerges, because right now, really, we have like 1.5 candidates, because it's former Dayton County Executive Kathleen Fault and Kathleen Weinhout who took steps. So she hasn't officially entered the race yet. Who else is going to come out? I heard from her, what I would consider a reliable source, who spoke with Russ Feingold 2 weeks ago in person and said that Russ is not getting into the race. Russ is not going to be running in 2012. It sounds like he's, enjoying his life out of politics. And it's almost embarrassing to say that because it's such a tumultuous time. But, there's something to be said for being away from something you've been doing for a long, long time. Obviously, there's people who would criticize Russ for even taking a step back and saying, we need you now. How can you take time off? But bottom line is, I'm confident that Russ Feingold is not running. So that means we've got to look at other candidates. Senator Erpenbach has been sending, I think, from what I'm reading, kind of mixed messages. Some news reports saying that he is maybe running, others saying that he's definitely not. I don't know. There's Congressman Obie, there's Congressman Kine, there's a couple of people out there, but so far all we have is who has announced.
And like you said, there's a lot of people whose names are being thrown around. There's Malin Mitchell who said he might run for lieutenant governor. There's all these names, but no one's other than Senator Feingold's really taking any steps to move forward with that, and other than Kathleen Falk as well.
Correct. And I think that having some good, smart, younger people step up and run for lieutenant governor is a great idea, because I'm sure you've heard there is some talk about having whoever runs against Walker in the recall be almost a placeholder to kind of just get Scott Walker out of there and then not himself or herself run for re-election and just make sure that we can kind of move the state forward. And so maybe having somebody in the position of lieutenant governor who give the position of lieutenant governor a little more responsibility and opportunity to prove themselves and to show themselves might be a great thing for bringing that next generation in. There's a lot of good ideas.
Well, what do you think about Obie or Senator Kolk?
I think those are great people, but I'm not seeing much in terms of activity from their campaign. Unless you're catching something, I'm not seeing anything come across radar from Dave Obie in about a week or two, and pretty much the same from Senator Kolk. Now, Senator Cole doesn't have as strong grassroots support in the research that I've done. Congressman Obie has a much stronger, people feel that he's a more passionate person, but I'm confident that if Senator Cole decided that this is something he wanted to do strongly, he has the means and a track record to put a message forward. That, he's got the name recognition, so I think those are very important factors on the state level. Something that Senator Cole ran into is that he's so well known locally, but you get beyond the area and many people don't know who he is. With Senator Cole, with Congressman Obie, they don't have that problem. But they've got to take the next steps. If the people, we have done what we were supposed to do. We got the signatures. Now it's up to our public servants to step up and say, yes, I'm going to take on Scott Walker.
And I hope we do get a lot more jumping in. It'd be nice to have 3 or 4 people running. And it would also be nice that they don't kind of destroy themselves in the process and they just kind of – I wouldn't know how they would run. I just hate to see them go, well, you shouldn't run because of. There's got to be a different way to be able to campaign where we don't shoot ourselves in the foot the entire way.
There's certain dynamics that if the race is close or – if people feel that it's to their advantage to go positive, then they stay positive. And that's a wonderful thing because obviously everybody wins when it's a positive campaign. I think that what we're seeing in the Republican presidential primary, when one candidate gets nervous that he's going to lose and he starts throwing negative ads, that's where you start to worry about really the influence of the outside money, where millions and millions of dollars were spent in Florida, and 92% of those ads, I saw a statistic somewhere that says 92% of those ads were negative ads. That's not going to help. Obviously, the economy is helping the United States and President Obama, but negative campaigning really doesn't help us as people. So I hope that everybody stays positive. I'm seeing the same thing in my primary, where I've got several good people that we're all competing, and I think the task in a primary like that, obviously we're on a much smaller scale than the governor would be or presidential campaign, but you talk about your record, and we have all of these individuals who have done something. None of them is a CEO of a pizza chain. We have people who have some record of accomplishment, and if they just talk about their record of accomplishment, I'm confident based on that alone, people would be able to make up their mind. And of course, the question of money comes in and competition. And so, again, we did what we were supposed to do. Let's see how our public servants handle their responsibilities.
Hey, Yuri, have you heard about, I'm changing the subject on you, have you heard about the bill that Joel Clayfish, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, is putting out regarding the hunting of sandhill cranes because they're destroying corn crops?
I actually did. I was up at the Capitol visiting with one of our local legislators yesterday, and was shown this very bill, and I could not believe it. It's, are we going to be hunting badgers next? But to be perfectly frank and honest, it is entirely possible that there's some kind of a management system that needs to be in place. But you know what? If Representative Clayfish proposes something, I think the smart and responsible thing to do is to get a second opinion.
Or a third.
Because it just sounds and looks bizarre, because it seems to me that not too long ago we spent a considerable amount of resources trying to bring population of these birds back. And now, apparently, in Representative Clayfish's opinion, we have too many of these. But Representative Clayfish, I'm following the assembly also because of the 44th district, but I'm seeing Representative Clayfish name on some very strange pieces of legislation, proposed legislation, such as looking to strengthen prenuptial agreements, which was something that was co-sponsored by the gentleman currently representing the 44th district, who I'm running against. So I kind of noticed that one. But there's just... I don't know who's, where Representative Clayfish's support comes from, but obviously the cranes are not going to be his support group anymore.
Poor
and I don't
crane.
Know anybody who, or that's, anybody who cares about cranes, frankly, for that matter.
That's, I was going to say, that's what they get for voting against him. Do you think that this is definitely a pandering to his base then, whoever the base is?
I hope so, because I would sincerely hope that there's some kind of a reason behind this. Because if this is a personal fear of birds, that would be just really bad. So I presume that there's some kind of an interest group that is lobbying Representative Clayfish the same way that there was probably some kind of a individual or two or three, that lobbied him on the strengthening of prenuptial agreements. Talk about a problem for one percenters. Do you know any of your friends who got a prenuptial agreement before they got married? It's not a 99% kind of a problem, in my opinion. So, yes, I would presume that there's an interest group behind it, and perhaps if we follow the contributions to Representative Clayfish's campaign, we can see where that interest group is.
Well, I'm wondering if the interest group is him. I'm wondering if he wants his prenuptial agreement strengthened. I'm wondering if the cranes aren't coming and eating a couple pieces of his corn. He's just getting kind of PO'd about it, and he wants just to take the whole group out. I wonder if he's just not his support group on this.
That is an interesting theory, where you have a legislator who is basically trying to solve his personal problems by introducing all of these pieces of legislation. In that case, I hope that things with Mr. and Mrs. Clayfish are amicable, and no, not one of them becomes a crane.
Well, that would be
yes,
bad.
Wow.
How How is, really quickly, how is hunting cranes and strengthening prenuptial agreements going to create jobs in Wisconsin?
Exactly. It's going to create jobs about as well as moving the sales of alcohol from 8 a.m. to 6 a.m. Our legislature is specializing in producing legislation that is great for morning talk shows, but it's not creating a single job. It's ridiculous. So I guess we should catch up on a couple of other pieces of news that are going through the state. We have the recall petitions that are being posted online, and I think that is a really, really big issue that really should be mentioned, because that is basically voter intimidation, where we have all these people who collected signatures, who stopped and signed petitions, and now all of their information is being put online. We had an issue in Janesville where the library was concerned about somebody gathering signatures, frankly, in terms of protecting the library patrons, because you have women who are sitting there, who are reading, somebody approaches them and asks them for a signature. You know, that was in the beginning of the recall process, and we worked everything out. But now you take these very petitions with all of these names and addresses and you put them online, besides just basic voter intimidation that's going to come from Walker campaign and Fitzgerald campaign, you have just plain danger to individuals whose name and addresses are now there for everyone to see.
Well, and a side note to that real fast. So the Fitzgerald campaign is sending out little postcards saying, did you sign my recall petition, as another way of voter intimidation? And I think a couple people said that they just said, yes, I did, and sent it back or ripped it up or whatever they did. One person had a really unique way of dealing with it. She sent Senator Fitzgerald a email asking him if he actually sent the postcard to her. So I thought that was a kind of a great way of doing it. Did you send the postcard to me? Just checking. Just want to make sure that you were the one that sent the postcard.
There's a lot of creative people in our great state.
All right, what?
Go ahead.
No, finish what you're going to say real fast.
Oh, you know, there's trying to just kind of scan through the news and keep everyone abreast of the situation. And, of course, we have Scott Walker still vowing to find somewhere 250,000 jobs if he survives a recall, which just proves that there's nothing wrong with saying whatever it is you think other people want to hear, and just total disregard for reality, for facts. Really, it just sounds disrespectful of people that are still listening to Scott Walker to say that he's going to create 250,000 jobs. It made no sense when he first said it. It frankly makes even less sense now. But he keeps pushing with it because he must think it's a winning talking point. So there are all these headlines saying Walker renews promise of 250,000 new jobs.
Well, it's probably one of those things that you say a lie long enough, it becomes true.
At least to those that are paying, that are on his payroll. Go ahead.
Exactly. I was going to say, Yuri, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on this week, and we'll talk to you next week then.
Sounds great. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye. That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup.
It was clear tonight, and it's clearer more than ever, that the governor truly does not understand the state of working families in Wisconsin. He does understand what it means to lose your health care. He does understand what it means to have your children crowded into more crowded school classrooms. He does understand what it means to have a reduction in your hours or a loss of your job altogether.
That was Senator Mark Miller, who was responding to the State of the State address by Governor Walker. And with us now is Representative Fred Clark from the 42nd Assembly District. Good morning, Representative Clark. How are you this morning?
Good. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being on the show. And since I started off with Senator Miller, I thought maybe you might have something you'd like to say about the State of the State address that Walker gave last week.
Yeah, well, I just would echo the comments of your previous caller. You know, the governor is well aware of how deeply divided this state is, because he literally can't go anywhere in this state, including his own State of the State address, without citizens letting him know how badly he's performed. And so, well, he said the word jobs something like 27 times in that State of the State address. The reality is there's almost no significant initiative that he's put forward that's actually contributing to job creation. And, you know, as was mentioned, that this mantra of 250,000 jobs that he promises to create, that he promised to tattoo on the foreheads of his cabinet secretaries, the reality is after more than a year in, we've lost more states in the last six, more jobs in the last 6 months than any other state in the nation. And we are now the laggard in the United States in job creation. And that loss of jobs is directly a result of the policies of this administration.
Well, in a State of the State, he requested that businesses hire one additional employee. Do you know how many have actually hired one additional employee?
I don't know how many businesses have answered the call and stepped up to hire one additional employee. That's certainly a nice-sounding call to arms, and you know, but it's also just divorced from reality. You know, businesses hire employees when there's demand for their product or their service, and when they have an opportunity for growth. Most small businesses that I'm familiar with, and I've been a small business owner myself, are struggling right now to make it through the end of every month and pay the employees that they have. So you know, we're just waving a wand and wishing that we could all do this as an act of faith is it just couldn't be more in the ether, you know, especially in light of what we've done to actually drive employers out of this state. You know, the governor's first act before he was even elected was to reject $810 million in federal rail money that would have helped us develop a better passenger rail system in the state. Thousands of jobs would have been tied to that. You know, forcing a set of rules that prevent wind energy from being from achieving the growth opportunities in that sector is just two of a long list of examples of policies that have rewarded special interests, but have done so at the cost of job growth. And you know, now they're hitching everything to this proposal to build a mine in northern Wisconsin and call that their jobs agenda. And as my colleague Corey Mason said, let's get real.
Well, I'm going to go back to the jobs real fast before we move into the so-called mining jobs. What are some of the state impediments to developing jobs?
Well, first of all, there's sectors of the economy that need a stable policy environment in order to grow, and energy is one of the biggest ones. You know, with wind energy, we have a couple of $1 billion of potential investment that's sitting on the sidelines right now that isn't going to move until we have a regulatory environment that you know, balances private property rights with the certainty that developers need to know when they can put up a wind facility. But right now that won't happen. You know, our investment in programs like Focus on Energy and promoting energy sources that we grow here in Wisconsin, like corn and switchgrass and wood waste, that we have a huge resource from our productive lands that could be replacing coal and oil and helping meet our energy needs, and keep those dollars here at home. There's tremendous growth potential there. We're not achieving it because we're basically this governor is defending the status quo and handing the tax breaks to what are mostly out-of-state corporations. I'll just make one last point on that, and that a huge issue for many businesses right now is access to credit. And there's really a lending crisis around the country. It's partly a result of the 2008 financial meltdown. There are things that we can do and need to do to help make credit more available for small businesses, especially that can't borrow money from the banks right now for routine needs to grow and expand. And, you know, once again, these are the kind of, and we've introduced legislation to help do this, but instead this legislature is focused on divisive social issues like gun rights and taking away the rights of voters and hunting sandhill cranes and, as your caller previously mentioned, allowing people to buy liquor early in the morning. That's not helping put Wisconsin back on track.
So do you think that the government can help in the credit issue? Do you think that the Dems can get a bill out there that will help open up credit for some of these small businesses?
The answer is yes. We can't solve every problem in government, but we can help improve things. And that's an issue that's important to me. That's why I've introduced two bills, actually, to help do that. One would be to simply grow our very successful small business loan guarantee program that we operate within our Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And loan guarantees are a very effective way to leverage a relatively small amount of taxpayer dollars to help backstop loans that commercial banks and credit unions can make and basically get more lending dollars in the hands of businesses so they can grow and put on employees or invest in the new equipment that they need in order to thrive. That's a big bottleneck in job creation right now, and we could be doing things to address that, and we haven't.
Well, I'm going to get to the mining bill before our bottom of the hour break here and segue in with the jobs. Now, I call this the giveaway to the mining company's mining bill, and I know the Republicans have this job session that they have put out, and the only jobs that they've been talking about are these mining jobs. How many mining jobs are there actually going to be, and how many of these jobs are actually going to be people that live in Wisconsin that are getting hired for these positions?
Well, those are really good questions, and no one can say with any certainty or even predict what a likely answer to that would be. And that's largely because the company that's been proposing this mine, Gugibic Taconite, it's a subsidiary of the Klein Corporation, never done business in Wisconsin, but they are extorting the citizens of the Northwoods and extorting this legislature to pass a bill, to an extreme version of a mining bill that would roll back environmental regulations on mines on their promise that it would create 700 jobs. They've provided almost no detail, no significant detail about what their mine operation would actually look like, but they have made it clear in testimony that most of those initial jobs would go to skilled engineers and mine operators that are going to relocate here from other states. So we truly don't know how many, you know, Wisconsin families will stand the benefit of mining jobs. But, you know, we need to be clear that as one of my colleagues pointed out, this is not your grandfather's mine. This isn't the kind of deep shaft mine that you know, our grandparents remember from 80 years ago in Wisconsin. This is a huge, highly mechanized, open pit mine operation. It employs a relatively small number of people, but creates extensive environmental impacts.
I'm going to take a quick break, so we'll be right back. We're listening to, we're actually speaking with Representative Fred Clark from the 42nd Assembly District, and you're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show. Sarah Schultz, if you have any questions for Representative Clark, you can call in at 877-497-1797.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says Indiana's so-called right-to-work law is a sad day for working Hoosiers and reflects an extreme partisan agenda. Trumka says study after study shows that this anti-union legislation reduces wages, benefits, and safety for all working people. He says it's a shame that flip-flopping politicians like Governor Mitch Daniels focus on divisive partisan agendas instead of on how to create good jobs. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says that the anti-union law is an attack on millions of working men and women in Indiana. The labor leaders said working people will remember at election time who stood with working families and who stood with the one percenters. Indiana passed that law once before, back in 1957, Hoffa said, only to see it repealed in 1965 when the people elected pro-labor Democrats to the state legislature. In 1961, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. warned the country that right to work provides no rights and no work. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining. Daniels told the Teamsters in 2006 he had no intentions of supporting that so-called right-to-work legislation. One of the big questions for the Super Bowl is, will there be a demonstration supporting workers who are impacted by the right-to-work bill that was signed into law Wednesday by Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels? The NFL Players Association and a number of players who will be participating in the Super Bowl game have expressed opposition to the legislation. On Wednesday, shortly after Daniels signed the bill, workers marched from the State House to Super Bowl Village. Many of those marching had a hand in building the stadium, skills they say were developed as members of organized labor. The Center for Law and Social Policy says two highly controversial proposed changes to the unemployment insurance system would penalize the most vulnerable workers. Federal unemployment benefits expire February 28th unless Congress extends them. Republicans in the House want to force jobless workers to be drug tested and to have high school diplomas in order to get the benefits that they worked hard to earn. The Center for Law and Policy says these measures invade privacy and may be unconstitutional. Workers earn the right to unemployment benefits by having held a job, and the center says workers should not be held to different standards based on their levels of education. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and I am speaking with Representative Fred Clark from the 42nd Assembly District. If you have any questions for Representative Clark, you can always call in at 877-497-1797 or join our live chat room and ask questions there as well. Now, Representative Clark, getting back to the mining bill, who let Klein in at all? I mean, did they just come in and were able to buy up the property that the other three mining companies that owned the Pinoki Hills have? Did they just come in and buy it? Or?
Yeah. Well, yeah, what Klein has done, you know, Klein is an LLC. It's a multi-billion dollar LLC owned by Chris Klein. He's a fantastically wealthy mine operator with a frankly, a history of coal mining, mostly in Appalachia and Illinois and other parts of the world. But they bought up the mineral rights throughout the Pinoki Hills that would give them the ability to expand this mine to about 22 miles through the heart of the Pinoki Hills and in one of the most pristine watersheds in Wisconsin. They've had an office in Hurley for about the last year. They've held a permit, an exploratory permit from the DNR during that time to actually begin, you know, testing the rock formations that are there and evaluating the chemical composition and whatnot. But the only thing they've really done during that time is function like a campaign office. And they basically said to that community, we're ready to come and create these jobs, but first you got to change the law or we're not going to lift a finger. And that is what I think many of us just believe is irresponsible, to roll over and let them dictate law that will affect the entire state on their threat to go home if they don't get what they want. You know, as many of us look at it, you know, we're the ones, the people of the state own this ore body. We're the ones that should be negotiating from a position of power. But quite honestly, the legislators who drafted this bill have given them everything they've wanted. And that's not going to be good for the people of the Northwoods.
Well, especially since that bill really did talk about the water and allowing within a mile to not be tested, when we already have water problems from the Ladysmith from the Flambeau mine, where they had to close wells and they seem to have a high rate of cancer that's being observed there, and no one can explain the cause, even though it's probably from the mine and probably the water contaminated from the mine. So, yeah. I mean, obviously this is the mining company said, here, make it so we don't have to pay for anything, especially after we mine, and we're happy to come in.
Exactly. And you know, the mine itself, depending on what happens in the iron industry, may be economically productive for 20, 30 years, maybe more, maybe less, but it's a very volatile industry right now. But the impact of polluting the groundwater with acidification that may occur from removing all of this overburden and piling it in wetlands and streams, the potential for toxicity from arsenic and mercury and lead, that will persist for hundreds of years if it isn't done right. And that would be just a terrible bargain for the people of the Northwoods and for their economy. Many of us are of the opinion that it's possible to do mining right, but the bill that has passed in the assembly now is not going to help us do that. It's the wrong way to go about it. Finally, I'll say on that subject, what's been a very sore point on this bill for local people who have initially supported the idea of having a mine because they do need jobs, has been the provision that would take 50% or 40% of what's called the net revenue proceeds, which is basically the taxes the mine operator would pay, and instead of giving it to the local communities, which has always been the way our mine laws have worked, they want to send 40% of that money back to the state to help fill the state budget. And this is money that's intended for local economic development, for roads, bridges, schools, quality of life investments that need to happen around mine communities. And a lot of local mayors and elected officials are strongly opposed to this bill because the Republican legislators who passed it decided in their wisdom that they were going to take that away from them. It's not good policy.
That seems to be a trademark of the Republican legislature, not good policy.
I guess that's an understatement. After the hours and hours of testimony that this committee heard, the bill they've produced really doesn't appear to reflect in any way the main concerns that have been brought forward, both by Native American tribes like the Bad River, as well as citizens who are going to be affected by a reduced quality of life and a dirtier, poorer environment if this mine isn't permitted properly.
I'm going to move on to the Grossman bill. Speaking of bad policy, the Grossman bill, this basically allows people to donate and then keep their place of business quiet. Can you fill in on that a little bit?
Well, sure. Our current campaign law requires campaign contributors above a threshold dollar amount to identify their employer and their occupation. And the bill that Senator Grossman's introduced would remove that requirement. And, you know, this is really an important part of transparency in politics. There have been so many assaults on open government this year, both at the federal level and the state level. And, you know, with Citizens United Supreme Court ruling, we're seeing just this tsunami of unregulated campaign spending that's beginning to occur. But our state law has always been reasonably strong, and it's required campaign donors to identify who they work for. And that's what allows citizens to, that's what allows the public to understand who's actually funding campaigns. So when the Klein Mining Company has executives and employees contributing money to campaigns, or any other company, this is what allows the public to know that. And taking that away is just taking one more building block away of having open, transparent campaigns, and the public has a right to know this.
Do you think this bill is a direct effect on all the Walker donors that got picketed and got boycotted earlier early last year?
Well, I don't want to speak to the motivations of the authors. I think that's for them to defend. But, you know, clearly, if the public doesn't know who campaign contributors are working for, it makes it much more difficult to understand what the real influences are behind campaigns. And so, you know, if the key employees of any corporation are all contributing to the same candidates, that should be a signal that there's some coordinated effort going on there, or at least it's enough to raise a flag, and people have a right to know that. So I think the bill introduced by the senator is not moving us in the direction that Wisconsin citizens expect us to be, given the tradition we've had in the state of open government.
So basically, it's just making things less transparent, as apparently this is another Republican kind of, they've been doing this whole last year. It's just one more way to keep more closed government and less transparent government.
Well, I think that's right. And you know, put that in context of the way that redistricting was done this year, and how new legislative boundaries were drawn a year early in the most partisan way possible, with very little, really no real public input, but done behind the scenes with a law firm that was consulting with the Republican Party, was paid for by taxpayers, and that disenfranchised, you know, hundreds of thousands of voters around the state. So this is really part of a trend, sort of stripping away the open government tradition that we've had in the state and the fair campaign tradition that we've had. But people are following these issues. I think citizens are, you know, it's maybe one of the bright linings in what has happened in Wisconsin this year, is that so many citizens have started very closely following what happens in state government like they never have before. And proposals like this don't automatically sail through, because people are paying attention, and rightfully so, you know, shining the light on proposals like this. And I think that's encouraging.
It is, and I know you have to get going, but before you leave, I really want to hit on a bill that you are an author of, or I don't know if you're a co-author, but definitely an author of, and it's your foreclosure bill. Can you talk for just the last few minutes on what that bill entails and what you're hoping it will do for the state of Wisconsin?
Well, sure. The bill we introduced on home foreclosures came out of a collaborative effort that I was a task force I was part of last session with bipartisan makeup from the State Assembly and with experts in the banking and credit and realtors and municipalities to look at the problem of home foreclosures. And as most of your listeners know, foreclosures have been at record highs for the last 3 years in this state. It's one of the major fallouts of the banking crisis that led to the recession in 2008. And because so many of these mortgages that were sold aggressively, you know, included things like teaser rates and these balloons and very attractive initial rates that were structured to reset later, a lot of homeowners today are underwater. And for borrowers that are behind in their mortgages, many banks are simply foreclosing. They're so swamped by the rate of foreclosures and the rate of mortgages that are in distress that they've been unable to deal with it responsibly. So the home foreclosure bill simply requires lenders to verify that they have sat down and attempted to modify their mortgage terms with their borrowers before they can ask for a foreclosure judgment from a state court. And it's what responsible lenders already do. It's what we know our community banks and our small banks in Wisconsin already do. But unfortunately, the big banks, the, you know, Countrywides and the large, you know, multi-state mortgage lenders have not had the resources to do this properly, and we need to force them to. It's just what's fair for borrowers. And ultimately, if we can keep people in their homes that have the ability to pay a mortgage, everybody wins. The family wins who's not dispossessed of their home. The community wins because the property remains on the tax rolls and that home in that neighborhood's occupied. And we don't see, we're minimizing the glut of unsold homes that are on the market. So I'm hoping we can get a hearing on this bill yet this session. It remains a key problem. If you've got any more interest in it, I'd encourage your listeners to contact my office at 266-7746. It's area code 608.
Can you repeat that number again, please?
Yeah, the 42nd District Assembly office is area code 608-266-7746.
And that's to get more information on your foreclosure bill, which is, that's amazing. I know Walworth County, where I live in, 2 years ago had the highest foreclosure rate in the state of Wisconsin. And as I walk around my community, I can't tell you how many houses are empty. And, of course, every community has their houses that have been abandoned. But there are more foreclosure houses. They're beautiful homes. They're in great shape. They just need the family. If the family could have stayed there, it would have helped our community, and it would have helped them. And it's just sad to see all this.
Exactly. And there's so many cases where, you know, these are responsible borrowers who maybe are behind a couple of payments, but with the ability to modify that mortgage, maybe, you know, restructure the term or allow them to get a reduced rate given what interest rates are right now. They can stay in that home, and you know, make no mistake about it, this is not only a personal tragedy for families when a foreclosure happens, but the economists are telling us that the number of foreclosures that are still out there is one of the major factors that is kind of holding back economic recovery. So the more that we can deal with that and reduce that problem, the better off everyone will be.
Well, when you lose the economic base of the taxes in the community, it drops that. You have people who had some sort of disposable income, which no longer have a disposable income, and aren't even living in your community to spend money in your community. I mean, the circle is just, it's amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I appreciate your interest in it. We can't give up on this one.
No, I am so excited that you have it out there, and I will definitely be keeping up on it, and I will be giving updates as we have them. So I'm hoping that we can get everyone to call in, maybe call their own legislature as well, and see if we can't get this bill up in session. I think it's really important.
Yeah, and can I make one more pitch? I actually don't have his number, but the chairman of the Financial Services Committee in the State Assembly is Representative William Kramer. He's a colleague who I have a lot of respect for, and I'm continuing to encourage him to hold a hearing on this committee. And I don't have his number, unfortunately, but if your listeners would want to contact his office and ask for a hearing on that bill, I'll make sure that, I think it would be valuable.
His phone number, Representative Bill Kramer's from the 97th Assembly District, is 608-266-8580. So anyone wants to call him to help push this bill along, then there it is. I'll repeat that in a moment, but I know we've kept you longer than I said we would. Thank you so much for your time, Representative Clark. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sarah. And happy to be on anytime.
Well, I'd love to have you back on again, especially to talk more about this bill and see where it goes. So thank you so much. You have a good day now.
Okay. Yep, you too. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. That was Representative Fred Clark from the 42nd Assembly District. And if again, the phone number to contact his office is 608-266-7746. Or if you want to contact Representative Bill Kramer to see if we can't get this bill pushed into legislation, 608-266-8580. Now, I have, we've talked about the State of the State address, and I'm sure you've heard bits and pieces of the State of the State address, but I don't think you've heard the Dems' response to the State of the State address. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the first. Now that I think about it, I don't know if I have time to play the first part. So what I'm actually going to do is do the break a little early. I usually try to do a top of the hour break, but we're going to do it a little early so we can get it in. And then I'm going to do the Dems' response to the State of the State address. I think it's important that you hear what they have to say, especially at the end. I left the questions in. It's on the second part. I left the questions in because I want you to hear what Senator Taylor had to say when someone asked about voucher schools. Actually, I want you to hear what the what they had to say about all the questions. But there was one particular question at the end about voucher school system. And the entire Dems, you can hear them in unison go, no. And then Senator Taylor came up and gave an impassioned couple-minute speech about Milwaukee and about how the voucher system in Milwaukee isn't working. It's phenomenal. So hold on to hear that, and we will be right back. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
You're to ask, why does it profit a man to gain the whole world and suffer the loss of his soul? Look at your body, you see on the rock below, as the tide begins to roll. But you invest in it, but you've never got to leave. They have won this war you're fighting.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. Now, like I said before the break, this is the Dems' response, the Democratic response to the State of the State address. I'm sure, again, you've all heard bits and pieces of Walker, or you've read his speech online, or you actually listened to the speech online. But I haven't yet seen a place where, other than maybe going to the Democratic legislators' websites, that you can actually hear the response. Their response to the State of the State. I think they put it on TV. I actually don't have one, so I don't know. But if you got to watch it, it was really interesting what they said and how they said it. And again, the last part of this, at the end, so one of the questions was on school vouchers. You really got to hang on and listen to what Senator Taylor said. It was amazing and well done. And without further delay, here is the Dems' response to the State address.
Well, thank you all for being here. I'm here with our colleagues from the Senate and the Assembly in order to respond to some of the points that have been brought forward, and any of the members who are here will be happy to answer questions at the conclusion of just some brief remarks that a few of us will be making. What we didn't hear tonight, which is the truth, is that the state of our state is divided and broken. Wisconsin, previously recognized nationally as a leader in public education, health care, and good government, is now polarized and broken. We are among the top in the nation for damaging cuts to public education in the university system, and we are the only state in the entire country that lost jobs each and every month for the last 6 months. We didn't hear about that tonight. Let me repeat it. Wisconsin has lost jobs every one of the last 6 months since the governor passed his budget and put his economic plan in effect. Scott Walker made a promise to the people of Wisconsin when he was a candidate for governor. He said it was so vital he was going to tattoo it on the foreheads of his cabinet secretaries. I didn't see that tattoo tonight. That tattoo was supposed to say that they promised to create 250,000 jobs. Well, we're moving backwards. We did not hear any update on that promise tonight because he is so far off track in terms of attempting to accomplish that goal because he's not working together. Instead, we heard about rates of business climate, and he avoided talking about his central campaign promise. Governor Walker claimed tonight he's turned things around. Let's review the past year. Cuts to public education. The District Administrators Association said two-thirds of the schools have had increased class sizes or cut back on course offerings. Crowded classrooms, job losses, rising tuitions, family losing their health care. Governor Walker certainly has turned Wisconsin around, but unfortunately, we're headed in the wrong direction. It has become difficult to believe the messages coming forward because his rhetoric bears no resemblance to reality. It's not working for the middle class, who are being asked to shoulder all the pain of the cuts while Republicans gave away $2.3 billion to privileged special interests over the next 10 years. It's not working. Governor Walker is taking the state in the wrong direction, and people are talking about it all across the state. It's time for a change in direction. Governor Walker is ignoring Wisconsin values of working together. The middle class has seen the things we value most, education, health care, job training, public safety, local services attacked. That is what the working people of Wisconsin are speaking out against. The state of Wisconsin is divided and broken. It's time we reverse course, work together for real solutions, in Hill, Wisconsin. Thank you very much, and now we're going to hear from the Senate Minority Leader, Mark Miller.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you all for coming. You know, it's always a challenge to follow Peter because he always says everything that you're intending to say. But, you know, it was clear tonight, and it's clearer more than ever, that the governor truly does not understand the state of working families in Wisconsin. He doesn't understand what it means to lose your health care. He doesn't understand what it means to have your children crowded into more crowded school classrooms. He doesn't understand what it means to have a reduction in your hours or a loss of your job altogether. Tonight, what we heard was not a state of the state address, but a state of delusion address.
Yeah.
6 straight months of job losses, tax increases on seniors and working families. That tax increases occurred to reductions in the homestead tax credit and earned income tax credit. $400 million in fund raids. $111 million in fee increases. $107 million in tuition increases and credit card spending. $2.36 billion worth of tax credits to big corporations and special interests at the expense of investments in education for our school children, education for our college students, education for working men and women who need to get the advanced training to fill the jobs that manufacturers are looking for in our state. That is what we need to have an investment in, and that is what has failed to happen. The governor's policies and the Republican policies have moved Wisconsin backwards. As my great friend Peter Barker just indicated, we have turned the corner, but we are going backwards. We have changed direction, but that direction is the wrong direction. Tonight, we thought we would hear more about initiatives to create jobs since the policies that have been put in place have not taken us backwards. There is no recognition that we're going backwards. Instead, we heard about job fairs. Usually, at the State of the State address, the governor lays out a vision for the future. All we heard tonight was a detailed listing of the policies that have brought us to this sad state. We know that the people of Wisconsin are among the hardest working people in the country. If there was a job for them to take, they would take it. We know that the governor bragged about the fact that we are at 7.1% unemployment rate. That does not take into account the discouraged workers who have stopped looking for a job because we are losing jobs in our state. My colleagues here, the Democrats, we will continue to fight for well-paying jobs, support the new economy industry that is absolutely essential if we're going to go forward with good high-tech manufacturing and research.
preserve access to quality, affordable health care for our children, families, and seniors, and ensure that our children have access to a world-class education, and that our workers have access to job training so that our employers have access to a good quality workforce. That is our vision for the future. That is a vision that will get our people back to work. That is a vision that will put money in people's pockets, that will create the economic demand for more jobs in our state. I'm pleased to introduce Representative Sonny Pope Roberts.
As we have come to learn over the past year, the word reform has a different meaning to some than it does to others. In order to justify reduced funding to our state's public schools by a massive $1.6 billion, Governor Walker has launched a multi-million dollar campaign to convince citizens and voters that his actions amounted to bold education reform. Governor Walker has launched a multi-million dollar campaign to convince citizens and voters that his actions amounted to bold education reform. Well, I'm here to tell you that they do not. Every legislature makes difficult choices that reflect their priorities. Unfortunately, poor decisions can cause devastating outcomes. After doing some cursory research, I was able to compile a list of 41 school districts that are facing major budgetary issues heading into the 2012-13 school year. And this is just the beginning of a list that will certainly grow as districts start the difficult task of assembling their next budget. The problems before them are a direct result of the decisions made by Governor Walker and the Republican leadership to prioritize corporate donors and unaccountable taxpayer-funded voucher schools over our public school children. Not only is this agenda not working as advertised, it is not real reform. Just this past week, the governor and Republican leaders announced that they are planning to hijack control of two different education reform efforts, neither of which have completed their final recommendations. This power grab is an affront to the process of working together for real solutions, and it casts a shadow over what were previously bipartisan efforts to improve our schools. This is another clear example of students taking a back seat to politics and partisan political gain. And this not only hurts Wisconsin families, it hurts our state's future for economic prosperity. There is, and there always has been, a better way to conduct business, the Wisconsin way. Wisconsinites have come to expect a high-quality public school system that provides a level playing field for all students, and we cannot, and we must not, forget that commitment. By dedicating funding to the state level, we can alleviate the pressure on our property taxpayers. Instead of paying back political supporters, we should be investing in our state's future. Thank you. I would like to introduce Senator Julie Lassa, who will talk about jobs and the economy.
Well, good evening. It is clear that Governor Walker tonight is continuing to promote the same failed policies that have divided our state and caused six straight months of job losses. After promising to create a quarter million jobs, the governor and the Republicans in the legislature have focused instead on handing out $2.3 billion in giveaways, tax giveaways to big corporations and special interests, weakening protections for consumers and the environment, and decimating public education and health care. We see the results of those policies all around us. While the rest of the country is experiencing positive economic growth, while our neighboring states are adding jobs, Wisconsin has lost over 35,000 jobs ever since Governor Walker's policies took effect. We are clearly headed in the wrong direction. The quarter of a million unemployed Wisconsin workers in our state are tired of waiting for jobs. I and my Democratic colleagues have brought forth numerous solid proposals that will help to get our workers back to work where they want to be. We have been at the table, ready to work with Governor Walker and our Republican colleagues to get the job done. But unfortunately, they have been unwilling to work with us up until this point, and we are hoping that within the few short months that we have left of this session, that they will meet us at the table and be able to work with us to pass policies that actually get people back to work. I hope that Governor Walker will listen to the people of Wisconsin and be the leader that we deserve by helping to bring this state together instead of creating even more division.
If anybody has any questions for any members that are here, I'd be happy to answer them.
Is the state broke or isn't the state broke?
You know, let me say one word in that regard. You know, it's interesting because, of course, the governor's been saying it's been broke since virtually the first day he took office. But just last week, you know, Secretary Hitch sent a letter to certify that the state has a deficit going forward after he said he balanced the budget. This is another example of this rhetoric versus reality. So I don't know, is there a relative prosperity now where we can afford to actually begin to fund our public education system, to have job training, to close that skills gap that he talked about tonight? Or do we have a deficit so that they can take 30,000 children off of Badger Care, which is why they made that statement?
Representative Barkey, you said we lost jobs 6 months in a row, but he's in there saying that we have the highest rate of job creation in the state, among the states. I mean, is the numbers twisted? I guess what's your explanation for him being able to do that?
Well, look, it's another example of, you know, rhetoric versus reality. You know, these numbers that are put out in terms of the number of people, the number of net new jobs created or lost every month, and it's clear, during the last 6 months, we have lost jobs each and every month. We're the only state in the nation to have that distinction. So his policies are not working.
You know, part of what the governor is claiming credit for is the momentum created by the jobs that were created under the prior administration that carried over into the first few months of his administration. Without that impetus, we would be in a much worse condition, because once the governor's policies went into effect, we have lost jobs every single month since. 6 months. Six continuous months of job loss in the state of Wisconsin. We need to get Wisconsin working again. That is our number one job. We need to get the people who actually do the jobs in Wisconsin, not the politicians, back to work.
What is your reaction to what happened in the gallery you're in?
You know, I think it's indicative of how severely this governor and the Republican agenda has divided our state. You know, this is when we need to be focusing on job creation. Instead, we have seen incredible division in our state. The public trust has been so abused that over a million Wisconsinites want the opportunity to withdraw their consent for this governor and this majority to continue governing.
Is this an appropriate place for the public to come in and act out and yell? Is there no body left in which they can have some decorum?
So we would prefer that, you know, obviously we prefer that people not speak out during the governor's speech or during any legislator's speak. And, you know, when we've been on the floor, we continually have reminded people about the rules of the House. And it's unfortunate when people do that. You know, it's unfortunate. Any other questions?
You guys were talking about education earlier. I saw that over half of minorities in the state fail to, in mass, fail to graduate from high school. Isn't it about time for a voucher program, or why is that so complicated?
Well, we're not from Madison, I don't know.
Hasn't the Milwaukee system been pretty successful?
No.
So the data is showing that you know, it has not been any more successful at all. The data has been very clear in that regard. Any other questions?
I can't resist. First of all,
here, Lena, come up here. Lena.
Come on, Lena. First of all, half of the minorities are not failing in the state. However, I will say that it's sad that we lead in the nation in the worst reading scores among fourth graders and eighth graders among African American children. To suggest that the voucher program is the savior of those issues is completely inaccurate. I think the issue at hand is, should we be funding education so that all children in public, in charter, or in the voucher program are going to get an adequate education? And the issue is we have the largest, if not the largest, the top cuts in the nation in education. We lost how many teachers, how many paraprofessionals, class sizes have been larger. So the question is, are we setting a legacy that will allow our children to be prepared for the jobs that Senator Lassa said that those parents need? I would argue that we're not preparing them. Our education system needs to be funded.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was the Dems' response to the State of the State address by Scott Walker. I love what Lena Taylor said at the end. She's an amazing woman. She's really spot on with everything that she says, and she says it with such passion, and it was so nice to hear her respond to that question, because obviously, well, to me it seems that some of these questions were rather set up, and people just either rather ignore the information, other information out there, or just really don't know the other information out there, and it was great to hear her speak up on that. Speaking of other information out there, I have Scott Witkoff with me, who is the blogger from Badger Democracy. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Good morning, Sarah. Doing well. How are you?
Good. I am doing okay, all things considered. So
good.
We're getting through the day. So you have been busy writing lots and lots and lots of things. And a couple of weeks, about a week ago, was it, that you wrote a blog on the John Doe investigation? Now, can you give an update on that? I know we had Chris Liebenthal on last week who gave us the timeline of where it started to where it was. And
sure.
I thought you could fill in a little more.
Well, the newest criminal charges, of course, were involved Darlene Wink and Kelly Reinfleisch, who, you know, Reinfleisch is a key Republican operative. She was the head of the Brett Davis fundraising push when he was running for lieutenant governor, supported by Scott Walker. And, of course, Darlene Wink was planning fundraising activities for Governor Walker during both of them during time while they were working for Milwaukee County. And the key thing that has come out of these new complaints and the new criminal charges is the existence of this top secret email system that the Walker allies within the county executive's office had set up within the county executive office using county resources to work on fundraising and political activities for Scott Walker while he was planning his gubernatorial campaign. And it was to such a point that they actually had a custom-made cabinet that housed the secret server for this email system that just a handful of people had access to. So that's huge. That's a huge development in this case, because now it goes from being, you know, just a bunch of Walker aides potentially outside of the, you know, Walker's direct reach to being something that happened within the county executive's office to the point where they set up their own little private server system.
So, well, and the interesting thing about that is I don't know if anyone else saw the diagram. It was pretty telling diagram. And I don't have it in front of me. I think I have it on my Facebook page. But it shows you where the secret little router was. And there it showed you five offices. Scott Walker's was on the far left, and then you had an office in between them. And then you had, I think it was Wink's office where that router was, wasn't it, Wink's?
Yeah, right. And Reinfleisch's office was 10 feet away from Walker. I mean, her door was six paces away from Scott Walker's. And he denied even knowing that she had been hired. She said that, you know, there were other people involved in her hiring, and here's this person who was working on was going to be working on Brett Davis's campaign, somebody who's very, very active in the Republican Party for a long time, who Walker would have known was involved in Republican campaigning activities, working in his office, who he would have no doubt seen every day. He couldn't have walked out of his office door and she walked out of her office door at the same time without them seeing each other. So that's really, you know, it's amazing that, you know, the last interview he did, I believe it was recorded by the Journal Sentinel. You know, my feeling is that that may have been Scott Walker's Richard Nixon moment of saying, I'm not a crook. I've never done anything wrong. And, you know, clearly there were things going on within his office that he would have had to know about.
Well, it's interesting. He keeps saying, I don't know, which puts them into two areas. It puts them into either incompetence or that he's lying. Like Reagan had said, I don't know, with the Iran-Contra affair. And at some point he didn't, but
right.
They were all underneath him, and he, in a way, gave the go-ahead to do it. So,
right.
You know, and it's interesting, too, that discussion had come up. I was watching, I think it was on Jimmy Carter, but don't quote me on this, where their advisors told Jimmy, it's better that you're incompetent, you look incompetent, than it is that you were wrong or you did something wrong. Because if you were incompetent, I believe their argument was you will be forgiven a lot easier.
Oh,
and
sure.
So I'm wondering how he's going to end up playing this. Is he going to go the incompetent route? Because that's kind of where people have already portrayed him as, look, he doesn't have a degree. He is rather incompetent. Where I think it's more of a case that he was now only semi-incompetent, but mostly a liar and tried to get away with everything he possibly can.
Yeah. I don't know how far the incompetency thing would fly with Walker, because if you listen to people who served with him when he was in the assembly or as county executive, is that he's a control freak, that he wants to have his hands in everything. He's a political junkie. He lives and breathes this stuff, and there's very little that he's not involved in. So that he may try playing that for the incompetent thing for a while, and he kind of alluded to that, saying, you know, I didn't know that Ryan Fleisch had even been hired. You know, we didn't know what Darlene Wink was doing, and when we did find out, we, you know, ended her employment with the county. So, yeah, there's a lot of that positioning going on, but in the end, I think the emails seem like the emails that they're working on, and the information on the hard drive is what is going to, you know, lead directly to whoever ends up being at the center of the investigation. And if you saw, I don't know if you saw the graphic in the State Journal, there was this great graphic with, you know, the pictures of the people involved and the people that had been charged. And, you know, it's one level removed from Scott Walker and, you know, Brett Davis. And whether or not Brett Davis knew what was going on, we don't know. It could have been that Walker was coordinating all this on his behalf to raise money for his campaign. We don't know. But, you know, these people are one level removed in the food chain from the top people. So it's very, very close to Walker. So.
And the beautiful thing is, too, is that now they're bringing in Reince Priebus. I think that's awesome. If Walker could take down all the high-ranking GOPers in Wisconsin, they all go down together, that would be pretty amazing to watch. And linking it to the RNC guy, the big head chairman RNC, because he got hired as soon as Walker and all his little cronies got put into place in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It will kind of be fun.
Yeah, and it looks bad. The thing is, perceptually it looks bad with the whole Rez Priebus RNC thing, but really it's possible that Priebus may not have done anything wrong because he was, you know, he's able to you know, contribute money on behalf of a candidate or, you know, campaign on behalf of a candidate in what his role was. So the fact that he's been brought in is more of a testament to, you know, the money in GOP politics and all the games that are getting played. You know, again, we don't know. It may just be something that looks bad, whether it was illegal or not. You know, maybe more of a stretch. I don't know. But, I mean, the big thing, obviously, is it's ongoing. It's broadening all the time. And it involves real estate deals. It involves fundraising and campaigning on county time. And then, of course, there's the Tim Russell, Brian Pyrick aspect of, you know, child enticement, that, you know, the embezzling from the veterans groups. So it's a ongoing probe that has three different arms to it, and where they'll all come together, who knows? But it's fascinating.
It is. It's really interesting to watch this play out. Now, what's your view on how the Journal Sentinel and other mainstream media have covered Walkergate?
Well, Dan Bice has done a fantastic job in his No Quarter section. He calls it a blog, but his No Quarter writings for the Journal Sentinel. And he's been just all over this thing. And now it would seem that based on some of these other reports that came out last week, it seems like he's got sources close to the investigation talking to him anonymously about things that they're able to talk about without violating the law, that are really giving close looks at the people involved and the chain of command. Like you said, how close it is to Walker, where, you know, these things took place. And, you know, that aspect of it, and the whole Walkergate thing, Dan Bice and the Journal Sentinel have been all over from day one. He broke the story, and he's just been all over it. So that's, and everybody's following his lead because he's got the information and the sources that are, you know, discussing this with him. So it's amazing. It's one of the good things that the Journal Sentinel's been covering in the past year.
The one thing that they did say, the Journal, I believe it was Dan Bice, and I have been following him. He's been really, really good with all the updates and stuff. But the one thing that I believe he did say that was very much like the caucus scandals of the early 2000s, that, and that's something Walker was around for but never got thrown into. What's your opinion on that?
Well, it's similar in that it's, you know, it's campaigning on the taxpayer dime, which is a felony. And so, you know, the caucus scandal took down Democratic and Republican leadership in the legislature at that time, Chuck Koala, Brian Burke, and Scott Jensen. And it was, you know, their staff was campaigning and operating campaign, campaign apparatus on state taxpayer dime with staff that are paid by the state of Wisconsin taxpayers to do state work, and that's felony. So there is a similarity in that that's the part of the nature of this John Doe probe. But the caucus scandal never broadened into the depths that this John Doe is going, where you have the real estate, the backdoor real estate deals and negotiations, and seems like rigged bidding processes that went on with county offices and in private office suites that were favorably bid out to favorable developers, and you know, these strange private super secret email servers and systems that people were operating from. So it's interesting that as the technology has advanced over the years, that, you know, the probe is widening, and who knows where the caucus scandal would have gone had they had the you know, the same technological, you know, systems in place that you're now to examine. So, you know, that's the similarity with the caucus scandal. And again, it brought down three big players in state politics. So, you know, this is just, it seems like this is just starting. Right now, it's brought down some minor players. And of course, the key to a John Doe is that you get the minor players to turn state's evidence against the bigger players in exchange for maybe reducing a felony to a misdemeanor. And that's most likely the direction they're going with Darlene Wink and Ryan Fleisch. So,
well, I believe Wink has already said that she was going to be a plea bargain and assist with
yep.
the investigation. I don't know if Ryan Fleisch has said that or not, but I believe Wink has already said that, and that would be huge. But before we continue
yep.
on with this discussion, we got to go for a quick break. So I am speaking with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Representative Fred Clark with this week's Democratic Address. As students return for the start of second semester classes here in Wisconsin, they're already experiencing the effects of Governor Walker's damaging cuts to our universities and our technical colleges. College students and their families are right to question why it makes sense to slash education budgets while spending lavishly on special interests and wealthy corporations here in Wisconsin. Governor Walker's talk about job training rings very hollow after he made more than $70 million in cuts to job training programs through our technical colleges. And any economist will tell you that in a time of economic turmoil and high unemployment, investing in job training is more important now than ever. The governor's decision could not have been worse timing for thousands of displaced Wisconsin workers and their families. So with recently announced lapses in state funding for our University of Wisconsin system, Wisconsin now also ranks third in the nation in cuts to our universities, and that's not an honor we should be proud of. And under Governor Walker, Wisconsin is already first in the nation in job losses, and we're the only state to lose jobs every month for the past 6 months. We're second in the nation in cuts to our K-12 education, our public schools, and these rankings, they're the opposite of the leadership that Wisconsin needs for our future. We know that a strong educational system is the engine that drives our state's economy. And Wisconsin has a long tradition of supporting our workers and a commitment to doing everything we can to help them find good, family-supporting jobs. The Governor Walker's cuts to job training in our universities break that commitment, and they cause us to fall further behind on the road to full economic recovery. So let's work together to invest in education and do what history has shown us works to put Wisconsin back to work. Thank you.
We're speaking with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy, and we're talking about the John Doe investigation. If you have any questions for Scott, you can call in at 877-497-1797 or ask on our chat room, which is at blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. I knew I would get that. There we go. So, Scott, getting back to the John Doe investigation, do you think that Walker would actually be our governor now? Because this investigation started while he was running for governor. Do you think Walker would be our governor now if the rest of the mainstream media, granted Vice did it, has done a great job, but the rest of the mainstream media, WTMJ and all the others, actually did a good job at vetting Walker and actually getting that information out there?
Oh, well, as far as the investigation goes, it's hard to say because obviously, that's a secret probe, and it's hard, you know, you're not going to know what going on, but obviously Milwaukee County knew about, because you have county supervisors coming out saying they're not surprised at this. And I think the biggest thing is, I don't think Walker would be governor now if we were all as engaged in the process as we are now. And, you know, if you look at the vote, you know, there was a huge number of union employees, both public and private sector, that voted for Scott Walker. And, you know, the people in Milwaukee County knew what he was about. And let's face it, the unions didn't get the word out to their members about what Scott Walker was like. And people weren't as engaged as they are now. And had, you know, if we stay engaged, then, you know, hindsight being 2020, no, he probably wouldn't be governor. You know, the other issue is, was Tom Barrett the best candidate to run against Scott Walker for governor? You know, again, hindsight 2020, I would have loved to see what would have happened if Barbara Lawton had been running against Scott Walker. I think it might have been a very different result, and people might have been a little more engaged. But that being said, I think it all revolves around us. And if, you know, I love that song by The Who that you played, "Won't Get Fooled Again," because, you know, if we stay engaged and if we stay informed and if we talk to each other and inform each other about what's going on, then we don't have situations like this where we kind of rest on the laurels of Obama's election and all the talk about hope and change. And, you know, we all were kind of asleep during the 2010 election. And, the results of the election proved that. You know, look at, you know, Russ Feingold losing to Ron Johnson. You know, if we had been engaged and informing people and talking like we are now about Ron Johnson and who he is and what he represents and what he doesn't know, then, you know, Russ Feingold probably doesn't lose his Senate seat. So that we all have to stay engaged. There's no more, you know, resting on our laurels or relying on the Democratic Party to do the work for us, because they can't and they won't. So it's up to us. And I think that's the message going forward.
And I want to talk more about the movement and other things, but I have one last question on the John Doe investigation. And that is, excuse me, if Walker gets indicted, how do you see that changing the recall election?
I don't know. I've heard a couple opinions. I heard one person said that with the recall being launched when it was, that even if Walker gets indicted and Clayfish, and he has to either resign or he's kicked out prior to a recall election, and Clayfish takes office as governor, that it doesn't matter because the recall's been launched, so then she would have to stand there, you know, the recall election as governor. I've also, John Nichols was on the other morning saying that nobody's sure because it's in uncharted waters and there's no precedent. So it's possible that if Rebecca Clayfish steps in as governor, that we may have to wait a year. And I've honestly heard conflicting discussion and arguments about that, and I don't think anybody really knows. And it's pointless for the GAB to issue a you know, an opinion on that anyway, because it would get challenged, and we may not know until that time comes, or it won't. And I honestly don't know. I like I said, I've heard varying things, and I have no idea how that's going to play out. It's anybody's guess. And until it happens and all the legal challenges get done, we won't know. So I would like to think that the recall would go forward, no matter who is there, but it's hard to say.
Yeah, I would too, because the thought of having Rebecca Clayfish as my governor frightens me more than having Walker.
Boy, having Ron Johnson as your senator and Rebecca Clayfish as governor is a, you know, how low can the bar be in any state for representation? So,
I know. It's a sad statement. Now, you had a really good point before I asked that question about us staying informed. And that leads me to one of the blogs you wrote about the progressive movement, and that the progressive movement is nonpartisan. It's not a Democratic movement. It's not a Republican movement. It's more of a people movement. And it is the fact that we have to stay informed. And it's the fact that we have to keep up what's going on. When we don't, we do get a Ron Johnson or a Scott Walker, Rebecca Clayfish ticket, or we get some of the people that are on our village boards or school boards or county boards. And you can't lose sight of any of those races, because what they can't do, if you get the right people in the legislature, in the Senate, the Assembly, and the governorship, they can turn it all around on your local level. So it's really important that you do stay engaged and stay informed, and that this movement moves forward. Can you talk more about what you blogged about it?
Sure. And it was, you know, the blog is a remark that I gave to a recall kind of party celebration up in Jackson County. And it was basically just kind of consolidating a lot of writings and opinions and, you know, other people's thoughts and platforms. But really, the message is pretty close to what you said, is that this is about all of us. And the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, you know, all have their ties to certain corporate interests and certain special interests. And we've seen what happens when we rely on them. Same with, you know, whatever group is around at the moment, whether it be United Wisconsin or any other group. And this is about the people. And the people have to come together, and the people have to change the course of where we're headed. And that was kind of the bottom line of the blog. And it, you know, points to the history of the progressive movement, which started almost exactly a century ago with Bob La Follette and, you know, his ideas of what government should be. And it should be that, you know, government is, you know, should ensure well-constructed legislation that's benefiting the greatest number of people. And it should be clean, honest, and accountable. And we've gotten so far removed from that in both parties. And, you know, now we have a million people who've signed a petition to recall a sitting governor because of that type of corruption, cronyism, and now's the time for those million people plus to coalesce and change the course of not only our government, but, you know, nationally. And there are a lot of elements to that. There's voting that is key, getting people to vote, making sure people have their IDs, and then once we get our power back, as Senator Vinehout said, then we can change the law. We can repeal the voter ID law. We can repeal Act 10. We can do all these things that get us back on the progressive path. But it is all about us coming together and saying, you know, we're going to take our people back. And, you know, there are some key elements that I wrote about, and, you know, the collective bargaining being one of them, healthcare, public education, public works, you know, progressive taxes, you know, how corporations should function within the political system as far as being transparent and open and getting corporate money out of politics. So those are all progressive ideas that are a century old, and they've been lost, and now's the time when we need to get them back. And my point to the people in Jackson County who are all volunteers was the movement is bigger than any group. It's bigger than the Dems. It's bigger than United Wisconsin. It's bigger than it's all of us put together. And that's what it has to represent. So in a way, it's kind of a challenge.
It's a very big challenge. And we're actually fighting the same fight that Governor La Follette, and I believe it was also a senator too, La Follette,
right,
had to fight,
right,
100 years ago. It's the same thing. We're fighting the robber barons. And Governor La Follette was a Republican. Teddy Roosevelt, who was a huge progressive, started the Progressive Party, the Bull Party. He was a Republican.
Yep.
So you had some very strong progressives. A party didn't matter. It's the ideology behind it that matters.
Right. Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. And he was a, you know, he was a avid reader of, and, you know, some of your callers are going to fall off their chair when I say this. He was an avid reader of Karl Marx. And he had aspects of speeches that he gave in the State of the Union and, you know, during the Civil War that had aspects of, you know, Karl Marx's socialist writings in them. So, yes, we have a rich history of progressivism, socialism in this nation, and the debate has been taken so far to the right that to come back to the center is still so far right that we completely ignore that history and that, you know, that aspect of our politic that has been progressive, socialist, and, you know, we're a purple state. And for Tommy Thompson to say, we're a red state, we're always going to be a red state, I'm sorry, that's a lie. He knows it's a lie. Thompson never governed as an exclusively red governor. He was not a progressive governor. He did a lot of, you know, bad things when he was governor. But he knew that there had to be a mix, and he governed that way to some extent. So that's, you know, that's the bottom line here, is that we've moved so far to the right that to come back to the center is still so far right that we've missed a lot of our progressive and socialist values that we've had in the past. And these are things that, as the people, we need to recover in our government.
I think that's a great way to end it, Scott. I would love to have you back on. There's still more we haven't talked about. I wanted to get to the letter, open letter you wrote about Kathleen Falk. There's just so much more to talk about. We'll get you back on soon so we can talk more about this.
Sounds great, Sarah.
So,
and have a great week.
Oh, thank you. You too, Scott. We were listening to Scott Wyckoff from Badger Democracy. He's a blogger there, and his website is www.bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com. Now we're going to finish off the show. We're not going to do a break, but we're going to finish off the show with Nate Tim, and he is going to be talking about the Grassroots Festival that's going on February 18th. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for coming on and talking about it. Now, it's your group that's having this progressive festival, isn't it, on the 18th?
Yes. The Wisconsin Grassroots Network is sponsoring the festival this year. I've been doing this. This is the fourth annual, so I've done this three previous years, and it seems that every year there's a different group actually sponsoring. Of course, when I started in 2009, the organization I'm in now didn't exist, and there really was nothing but a group of people who were activated by the Obama campaign, and so it was pretty much local friends of mine that put on the first one, and the second two were put on by Dane County Grassroots Network, which are former Obama team leaders around the region, and this one is put on by the Wisconsin Grassroots Network because now we're looking to organize community groups across the state of Wisconsin. We have a different vision and therefore a different organization.
Well, what time will this, it's going to be all day on the 18th, correct?
That's correct. Registration starts at 8:30 to 9:20. Following that, we're going to have opening by the grannies. We always say the Pledge of Allegiance. We may even have a surprise political appearance by a guy that I heard cited in the previous interview, a tall guy from Illinois, and he might lead us in the pledge. We also will have Matt Rothschild, Mike McCabe, and Corliss Olson from the School for Workers giving mini keynotes. We have about 15 minutes for each keynoter, kind of set the tone for the events of the day.
And what are some of the sessions you're going to have? You're broken down into three sessions, and what are some of the things you're going to cover in the sessions?
Yes, there will be three sessions of about an hour, one in the morning and two in the afternoon, and then we have a special closing activity, which we'll talk about in a minute. The first session, round of sessions is seven choices. We've added one in the recent days, and they range from things like preventing the theft of our elections. We'll have a presenters forum. All of the people who gave talks will have a chance to answer questions and go into more depth on what they said. That's a separate group. How the legislation of the past year has affected Wisconsin consumers. We got a nice presentation on the mining issue up there, what's going on in northern Wisconsin. And one that's close to my heart is how to establish a grassroots group. And we're going to go into real detail if anybody really wants to step up and try to re-energize or energize democracy in their communities. We're going to have a panel of people who've been working on this share their experience, which should be real helpful to anybody who wants to do that.
And what's the cost to get in?
The cost is $14, which includes lunch.
Okay, and how many other groups are involved with this?
In terms of, what are you thinking?
Well, I know the grassroots network is sponsoring it, but are there any other sponsors involved with this? Are there any other, you've mentioned a lot. You mentioned Matt Rothschild and Mike McCabe and some of the others. Are there groups, they're part of helping sponsor this too?
Well, they're supporting it, but we don't deal in sponsorships. We sponsor this ourselves. These other organizations are all allies that support us. Lisa Graves is going to be there for Center for Media and Democracy. We have a lot of different. We have tabling options for anybody who wants to have a table there, $25, and we have about I think right now about 12 different groups that will be tabling on all different kinds of subjects. So it's open to all kinds of people, and we expect a big turnout this year. It's interesting that last year the first big rally was held on the day of the festival. So it's kind of a anniversary date, actually.
And it's kind of neat that you bring that up. How many, you said you've done this for 3 or 4 years. When have you usually, when has this festival usually gone on? Is it usually in February, or is it you just bringing it into February for the first anniversary?
No. Every year it's been on exactly the same weekend. It's exactly the same day, same Saturday, every year. And that's intentional. We want people to block their calendars for that date, and it's the time when there tends to be a downtime. You know, the Super Bowl's over, basketball tournaments haven't started, the wrestling tournaments haven't started. It's a time when people can focus on educational politics, and that's our primary focus.
And where is this being held at?
Wisconsin Heights High School, which is located on Highway 14. It's at, if people want to Google it, it's 10173 State Highway 14, which is located between Black Earth and Mazamani. It's at the high school there. I was the principal there years ago, so I'm privileged to be able to access that facility for this kind of an event.
And if people want more information about the sessions or maybe a more detailed map, what's the website they can go to for that?
Well, we're going to post up a website here in the near future. It's wpgfest.org, and they'll be able to get some additional information. They're welcome to call me. They want a table or, need some other detailed information. And my phone is 608-220-0139.
Okay, can you repeat that website and the phone number again?
It's wpgfest.org. And my phone number is 608 area code 220-0139. And
Go ahead.
Looking forward to a good turnout.
I'd say, how many did you have last year?
We had about 250, right in that range. And we're thinking it might be 350 this year or more.
Well, you've got a great lineup going on, you know, because what Lisa Gray is going to be talking about is ALEC. You've got some wonderful speakers, and it sounds like it'll be a great time. So I think if you got the time to get out there and you have the capability of getting out there, I think it's well worth your while to go. So thank you so much, Nate, for being on the show today and for talking about it. And definitely let me know when that website is up, and I will get that out to everybody and make sure that we can get as many people there as possible.
Remember, we're going to have the candidates at the end of the day, all the gubernatorial candidates that want to show. We've already got confirmation from Kathleen Falk, Kathleen Weinhout, and Malin Mitchell.
So that's going to be a great way to end it. So thanks, Nate. Thank you so much for being on. Good luck, and hopefully we'll see you out there.
Thank you.
That was Nate Tim from Grassroots Network, and that was the festival that's going on the 18th. Well, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for all his hard work on the show this week. You can download the show from iTunes or listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. Actually, it's blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can also listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the Sarah Schultz Show app for Android phones and iPhones. You tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. to WIDE 99.1 FM in Madison, on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. to WHYS at 96.3 FM in Eau Claire, and you can hear us now in Mukwonago, Waukesha on WFAQ 92.9 FM. Remember, Wisconsin, forward, together forward. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next Friday.